My name is Phil Lopez. I'm an Apache Indian from Colorado, really, in Seattle, Washington. My entry into this fabulous program that I, by the grace of God, was able to reach, I found out that I had a problem that I didn't know anything about. It was called alcoholism. And they took me to a meeting. And in this room, there were all kinds of men and women and kids. And I saw on the wall these signs, you know, meeting makers make it, and one day at a time, the slogans. And I wondered, what in the world am I doing here? I don't belong here, I don't think. But yet, I was there. And so they began to talk to me about the con job. You've been doing the con job on yourself, Phil, for a long time. You've been trying to destroy yourself with alcohol, whiskey, beer, wine, whatever else you could drink. And I just sat there and agreed, and I did. I drank it all, you know. And so they said, well, we're going to help you, but we're going to give you a book, a big book. It's got the steps in it. It's got the traditions in it. And you just take your time and read as much as you can and keep coming to this meeting. Every day we're here at 12 o'clock and we'll have a cup of coffee for you. And that's how it begins. And little by little, you're going to learn some things about yourself and all the rest of us that you never knew before. And all we ask is that you protect us, you know, and that we will help you all we can. We'll share with you another big book. One of the boys has got an extra one. So they'll give you a book, a copy, you know, make, follow us, because it's the 12 steps and 12 traditions involved. So they did, they handed me the books, and I began to read them, but I'd only gone to the 8th grade. I was an 8th grade dropout, so I was not an educated person. But I wanted what they had. I saw them laughing and smiling and so good about themselves that I could see that, and I don't think it was, if I could just be like that, I'd be happy. And little by little, they told me, meeting makers make it, so be at a meeting every day, you know, every day. And so I began to do what they said. They took me on 12-step calls to talk to other people in the weeds and in their big mansions and different homes that they had. And I heard their story, and I thought, wow. So I'm not alone anymore. There are a lot of people like me in the world. And little by little, I begin to work the steps. Step number one, admit I'm powerless over alcohol and my life has become unmanageable. Number one. And so on down the line, there's 12 steps there. And little by little, I begin to feel better. I begin to feel like, this is okay. Maybe I can make it here. I wasn't sure, but the maybe was there. And then they took me on a call. They said, come on, Phil, we're going to go make a 12-step call with somebody else, another guy. And so I jumped in the car with them, and they drove us to this dilapidated area and knocked on the door, and there was this guy going through the shakes, you know. And he invited us in, and we sat down. I just shut up and listened to them, but I could see everything they were saying was what I needed to say to the next guy, too. And so, it worked. We got him to go to meetings, and he stayed sober. He began to understand that for us it was like poison. To drink is to die, and the substitute is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Do the best you can. Nobody's perfect. You just do the best you can, you know. And people have come to meetings. And by the grace of God, I've been able to keep on doing that. Even though it's scary sometimes, because I don't want to do it. Or I think I've already done it, when in fact I haven't really done it completely. And so, but I got a good sponsor, Lou Charlie, from the first war over in Europe, who came home alive and made it. And he shared the story, his story with me, about the yellow fever epidemic that struck that part of the world. And the boys were coming home from the world there. And they were dying in barracks. They got this yellow fever, and they couldn't get enough volunteers. So Charlie volunteered to pull the bodies out, and he didn't get it. So he thought, maybe I guess God doesn't want me to have it. So he helped pull all those barracks full of soldiers that were just laying there, dying. And so Charlie made it. A lot of the other boys made it. And then Charlie gave me the first book that really got to me. It was he had all kinds of books in his house. And I had not been a book reader, so I didn't know what they were. But one day, he walked over to his shelf and he pulled out this one book. And he said, the name of this one, Phil, is the Koran. It's the great big book that will give you information about people all over the world. So take it home and read it, Phil. And anytime you want to talk about it, just ring me up, come over, and we'll sit down with the book, and I'll explain to you what it means. It's practicing the program. Practicing the program. Learning and unlearning. Learning and unlearning. And that's the way it's going to be for you for the rest of your life. You're going to be learning. And you're going to feel better. And you're going to help other people. And that's when the gifts come. When you're helping other people. Maybe in your own family. And that sparked me because I had three brothers that were two were in the penitentiary doing life in the parole. And the other one was in prison, doing time in prison. But they were like me. We were all alcoholics. And little by little, I didn't get a chance to get in on that because God was there with another new guy in prison that got to my brother John. Ernest got another guy who was in the state. It's like a prison, but he was working the program too. So he helped my brother Ernest, and the other one helped my brother John. And so this thing is the greatest thing that ever came down the pike. You know, I can't say enough for this program of Alcoholics Anonymous all over the world, because we're all over now. And so I'm ever grateful to God every day, by the grace of God, I'm still alive and I'm still sober and I'm still looking forward to better things. Thank you. Okay. Well, yes, like you were saying, I was asked to be on the job to put the Nelson Brigade together, which was a bomber in Seattle at Boeing Field. And I was a mechanic. I was commissioned as a mechanic to help build that airplane. And it was one of the greatest experiences I've ever had, was to watch that happen, because they told me the story that this is the one that's going to close the war, end the war over there in Japan, where they've been killing all of our friends, you know. And I'm so grateful to God that I was a sober, alive person to be a part of that. And so many other things that have happened to me, helping others, passing it on to other people, you know. No job is too bad or too scary or nothing. I seem to have lost my fears. I don't have them, you know. I know that with God, all things are possible. And that's what I go with. And so, I love AA and all the people that are in AA, because we're the most fortunate people in the world. And wherever we go, we bring ourselves, and wherever there's always somebody at the end of the trail that needs our help, and we're right there to do it. You know, step number one, if you're having trouble with your drugging, buddy, let me tell you, I used to be like that myself. I shared my story with him, and by the grace of God, I found AA, and the men and the women that helped me there, they gave me the big book to read. And so far, I'm okay, you know, and I'm getting better. I have to remind myself every day that I'm getting better, even though it doesn't look it on the outside. I don't have the money, and I don't have the house and all that stuff. But I'm just grateful to God that he touched me and gave me this wonderful program. Talk to you about losing my fingers, because that was very dramatic and very painful and very out of this world, as the kids say today. I was probably 13 years old. I was going to school. I was coming home after school, and I had found this box, little box, and I shook it because it had something in it. And the teacher took it away from me and put it on top of her desk, and she said, don't bring it back to school again. And she gave it back to me. But on the way back home, I had to cross the river, and the boys that were way ahead of me, they'd gone ahead of me, you know, so I'm by myself. And as I crossed the river, I sat down on a piece of cement, and I was curious about that little box. So I took it out and opened it up, and it was full of these little tiny empty bullets. That's what it looked like, empty bullets. And that's the last I remember, was sitting there holding them in this hand, and then everything turned white, an explosion. I guess it was an explosion because everything just turned white. And when I woke up in the hospital, and all these men were walking around the hospital, the bed, and they were talking, and they were saying, he's a goddamn miracle. He's a goddamn miracle. He had 25 of those cats in his hand, and only one went off. And when it went off, it just, like everything turned white, and I was in the middle of all this white light. And that's all I remember until they wheeled me into the hospital. And then in the hospital, these men, who were all from the company, I guess, and they were just walking around the bed, looking down and saying, that boy is a goddamn miracle. He's supposed to be alive. He's gone through something here that none of us would even dare try to get to, you know. But he's still alive. And that was my beginning to understand what has happened, truly happened to me. My curiosity as a boy made me so curious about those caps that I just had to know. And I don't know why I believed that if I took a match and put the match inside, it would be a sparkler like the 4th of July. But instead, it was an explosion, and it just, whew. You know, and everybody in the whole village heard the sound. It was a big explosion. And the first one to get to me was my grandmother, God bless her soul. She heard the explosion a mile and a half away, and she come running over and taking her sock and wrapped, tying it around as a tourniquet to stop the blood, because the blood was just gushing out. And so that's the last I remember, was that I'm going to sleep. And when I woke up, I was in this hospital, and all these men in business suits and all were walking around the bed looking down at me, and they were saying, you know, he's a goddamn miracle. He's a goddamn miracle. He had the whole box of these nitroglycerin caps, and only one went off. He's not supposed to be here. He's not supposed to be here, you know? And that's the end of my story, because I accepted where God put me. Right, the place I was born in Colorado, up in the mountains, everybody made home brew. And that's what they called it. It was a drink. And they called it home brew. And I, as a little boy, I noticed that some of the older people, they couldn't walk right. They were falling down and everything. But I was curious. I was more curious than about wanting some too. And so I started drinking it too. And pretty soon I discovered blackouts. I don't remember. I don't remember nothing that happened to me. And my friend said, God, there was a guy that just kicked you and beat you from your head to your toes. And you didn't feel that? I said, no, I didn't feel nothing. I was just numb. I wasn't there. Well, whatever that was, later I found out it was whiskey, okay? And it was powerful. I began to drink it whenever I had a chance. I thought I could get away with it. But always I'd slip over that edge and get too much. And then I'd black out. I couldn't remember where I was. And I'm over on the other side of town someplace. And I don't know how I got there. Blackouts, they called them. And then finally the law got hold of me. And they, of course, passed it on to my parents and said, he needs help. He needs professional help to get him off of that drug, because it is a drug. And so that was my start. And I've succeeded in doing that right up to this very moment. You know, I've had people offer me money, women, sex, all the sex you want, but take a drink. No, you ain't got enough money and you ain't good enough in bed. That's my answer. And I'll see you later. Happy drinking for you, not for me. So, I had to learn all that from the other old timers that were in the program. That's what they told me. But they did, they had to do too. So, it's progress in the family. Ironically, in my case, the three brothers, John, Ernest, and myself, all three of us were alcoholics. The older brother ended up in prison with no parole because he woke up with a dead woman in bed with her. And blackout, they called him. And he did life with no parole in one of the worst prisons in, up in the mountains in Colorado. It's nothing but rock. And then the other brother, he ended up in prison on the other side of the country. But he did his time and he got out. And he also got AA. Because they knew that I had gone AA. So they went to AA. They got sober. And I've seen too, so much of it from other people, friends of mine that aren't here no more. They died. They didn't make it back. I'm one of the lucky ones. So I'm grateful to pass it on to anybody, anywhere, anytime. If they just ask you. Thank you. Sometimes, as a typical alcoholic, I'd be in a blackout. And that's when you don't remember. You honestly do not remember. And they can throw you in jail and question you and everything, trying to get you to remember, and you don't remember. And that's where I'd end up. So then they'd throw me in the clinker, you know, and sleep it off there. Then pretty soon after so many days or something, they'd release me again. But then there'd be a different town and a different jail and a different arrest. I went through a whole maze of them, you know. When I sobered up, I realized, you know, that I was drinking. Every time I was drinking, I've got to do something about my drinking. So the key was, how do I do that? Well, go to AA, sit, go to those meetings and listen to what they say. And get a hold of that book, the big book, the big thick book. They had given me one, but I lost it, so I didn't have it anymore. So I went and I got a book, and I got a sponsor, Charlie, who was just back from that war over in Europe that he was in as an active alcoholic. When he came home, he got into AA, and so he was there for me. When he spotted me, he said, "You're another alkie, Phil." Said, I know all about it. I've been there too, you know. So he had a little shack on the beach, and there was books, open books after books after books. And I'd never been subjected to a lot of book reading. But one day, the gift that he gave me, the forever treasure too, was a book on the shelf. He says, "Here, it's a big book like this, like a Bible." And he said that. It's called the Koran, Bill. It's a Bible from people on the other side of the world. But the answers are very honest and very truthful answers. So take it home and read it. So I took it home and I began to study it, read it over and over, and begin to see how it really does work that way with other people. You know, when you're 12-stepping somebody who's got a drinking problem and he wants help. You know, I always tell them, there's a lot of literature available now. And the Koran was one for me. Now, the other ones were like Think and Grow Rich, Napoleon Hill. That's a famous little book that was still around in AA. And so, they told me, don't be afraid to open up books and read more, you know, because we need to educate ourselves so we know what we're talking about when we 12-step that other guy or woman or whatever, you know. And to this day, I have no problem. I think I got one in my hand or my pocket right here, right now. You know, I always carry one, you know, just in case. So I've done a lot of extensive reading, stuff from Europe, from Germany, France, England, from all over. And I don't remember the names now. It's been so long ago now. Mm-hmm. But don't be afraid to subject yourself to open discussions and exploring the unknown. Because as it was in the beginning, it was unknown. I didn't know what they were talking about. I didn't know their words. But little by little, I heard the word osmosis. I didn't know what that was. And then they said, well, you're doing it every day, Phil. You sit over here next to this old Joe over here who really has a program. And you're always listening to him all the time. You're getting it through osmosis, Phil. Mm-hmm. Well, so I got that through osmosis. So what a deal. Mm-hmm. You know, I never paid it for it either. Maybe I bought him a coffee or something. But that's back in the 20s, during the Great Depression in this country of America, they had what was called the Civilian Conservation Corps for kids, so that we could earn a few extra pennies to help our families out, because the Depression was on. Nobody had any money. Nobody had any jobs. So my dad says, sure, go ahead. So I joined. Well, what we were doing was fighting forest fires all over the mountains, and which was a different scene for us kids. But we learned real quickly from the old-timers and the old military old-timers, you know, Leo Wells. I never will forget that name, because he was a ranger, and he was in charge of us children. We were just children. But he would take us up in the mountains in those military trucks, and we'd all get to putting out those fires with picks and shovels and, you know. But ironically, one of the things that we ran into all the time was the Coca-Cola bottles. They were all over the mountains. They were broken up into pieces. And we kept coming back to camp and telling Leo Wells, the ranger that was in charge of us kids. And we'd sit down with him and we'd say, Leo, why don't you tell them that they ought to get the word out to Hires Root Beer or whoever makes these bottles of the beer and whatever. And he'd just laugh, because he was an alcoholic, too, active. He was always loaded, but we never thought about that, you know. So we fought fire after fire after fire, and hard work, heat, hot heat, you know. This is summertime, hot. And one of the stories about that is we're busy up in another mountain that just exploded over here beside us, and now we got to go up there and put that fire out. And while we were climbing the rocks and everything, we noticed they were all Coca-Cola bottles that had been, the tourists, when they drove by, they would throw them out the window, and they'd hit the rocks, and they'd burst. And so this thing was, the wine that was left in it, or whiskey, whatever it was, in that heat, it would ignite. And so we used to go to our leader, who was the ranger, the head ranger, and we'd say, Leo Wells, why don't you let them know that that company that makes these bottles should be stopped? Because we're sick and tired of running up and down those mountains now putting up those fires, you know? And all it is that Coca-Cola bottle that doesn't break because it's that thick in the bottom, and we have to pay for it, you know? So he just laughed, because he was an alcoholic too. So he just smiled at us. He never did go up. He never did do anything. But we learned the hard way there that, if you see those bottles, when that sunshine comes out full blast, those little glasses, little tiny pieces of glass in there, they're starting to sparkle all over the place. And if there's a leaf laying over here, it'll catch on fire. And then that'll catch the others on fire. And that's what we were fighting all the time. We couldn't put them out fast enough, you know? Mm-hmm. And the interesting part of this story is, again, we'd be so busy sweating. Oh, my God, did we sweat putting out those fires, you know? And then we didn't eat, because the truck was way over yonder, about 10 miles away. And we were already exhausted over here fighting forest fire. And I remember this one time that we did get the truck, and we did drive back to camp now. That was about 30 or 40 miles. And when we got to camp, the lieutenant, or captain, he had a captain's uniform on. He said, it's too late for you boys. You were too late. You weren't here on time. And I got mad. I got angry. And I told the guys, I said, stick with me. You guys stick with me. Don't run. Don't run. And I jumped on top of the table and I said, sir, I said, we've been up there fighting those forest fires now for over 14 hours. We haven't had a thing to eat. And we're not going to go anywhere until we get something to eat. And I told the guy, I said, you guys are with me, right? Yeah, we're with Phil. So the captain disappears. And then they start telling me, oh, shit, Phil, you're in trouble. You are in big time trouble now, man, with the captain. I said, I don't give a damn. The truth is the truth is the truth is the truth, you know? And so he never did, the captain never did come back. He disappeared. So we never got any help. But I would never take that back, no matter who asked me. I said, it was the truth. Those Coca-Cola bottles that would splinter all over those mountains and ignite when the sun come out and magnify them. And there'd be a fire there, and then there was over there, and another fire over there, and another one over there. So, where are you going to go first? Well, the quickest one is the nearest one. You know, pretty soon you're so exhausted, you heat from the hot. We're just barely making it, man. And yet we did stick, and we did make it. We did put the fires out. And yet that damn captain, and I used his name freely still to this day, because to us he was no man at all. He was just garbage as far as we were concerned. But that's some of the experiences that I went through personally with a bunch of guys, and I never will forget it. Okay, when I was at the CC's, I went to work with Boeing Aircraft, and they were building this new bomber, and because the war was on big time. And so I worked as a machinist. I took tests, and they told me when they finished the tests that I'd make a good machinist because I had good eyesight, and I could read, and I could multiply and mathematics, and I got by well, you know. And so they put me with the squadron that was in front so that we could get that Enola Gay together for the war. And that was something else, boy, because every day, there was no time for lunch. A lot of times we just had lunch on the run because somebody would be hollering at me from the other side of the building, you know. Phil, you got to get over here, man. We got to put this thing together so that thing can be ready and that thing can be ready. And it was like chaotic, you know. It didn't make sense. At the same time, that's when they brought all the girls, all the women from the United States. They were all coming over in boxcar loads of these women, you know. And they were coming in, and we'd see them at Boeing there, you know, in all shifts. Morning shift, noon shift, midnight shift. And we were just like a bunch of ants all over the airplanes, you know. And so the girls were good. The girls are good. Some of them were very good at what they did, you know. And us guys, we learned from the older guys, you know. I was always teaching the guys about grinding your stones down within a hundred thousandths of an inch. You can't see that with these eyes. You've got to have an instrument and to read the weight and the measurements. And so finally the day came when, first of all, where I got into trouble was I'm tired. We were running all the time. And I guess somebody got me to go downtown, let's have a few beers or something. Well, I went right for it, you know. And so I never made it to work that day or the next day. And the next thing I know, when I come into work, there's an envelope on top of my machine. And the older men said, you better open that envelope right away, Phil. So I opened it up, and it was a summons for my arrest. I had violated the law by not being on my job, see? And so I had to appear before this judge downtown Seattle. And boy, oh boy, they stomped on me. They made a fool out of me. They just put me down like you're worthless. This fits on a horn or whatever, you know. And, but I got through it. And so from that day on, I never lost a day's work. I was there early, 1 hour early, 2 hours early. I was there. So it worked for me. It didn't for everybody, though, because I'd see other guys that they got fired for that, you know. But I made it. And then, of course, we were right mixed with the military. All the guys in the military, we were rubbing shoulders with them all the time. And I remember them telling me about what's going on over there, you know, with Japan, what's about ready to go on over there. And so I'd relay the information to the rest of the guys and say, hey, man, don't do that. We're going to get some more help now. We're going to get some more help. We're going to be all right. We're going to be all right. And so when the Enola Gay was put together, that's the bomber that carried the three atomic bombs. They dropped 1, 2, 3 of them in Japan, and the war stopped. And Lord Hirohito, he knew that's the end for him, you know. But a lot of guys lost their lives in that one, too, you know. And so the rest of the story was just the peace and joy that came after the war was won. And it was so good to be, not to be in a hurry to get to work or report for any kind of duty anymore. You know, we were free. So I'm grateful to God that I had every experience I had. I would do it again, man. And if I had to, I would do it again. Because I never will forget the sacrifice that those women did. They sacrificed their lives and everything, man. You know, they wouldn't eat. They wouldn't take time to eat. The world didn't know that side of the story. But they sure as hell ought to, you know. Because that's the truth. It was the women who did so much of the work in that war. And I'm so grateful for every one of those women that was there to help me and assist me when I needed help. And for that I'm grateful eternally. And so they walked up and down the streets knocking on people's doors and asking if you had a basement in your house, if you got an extra room in your house. And that's how they found us places. And I had the good fortune of being taken to Mrs. Harry Truman. That house was a beautiful home in a beautiful area there in Seattle. And we could have the upstairs, and we could sleep. I'll sleep on the floor. We had one of these bunks that were pieced together, and so they were all over the floor. And then one crew had to get up early in the morning to be on the job, and those of us could get our sleep that night. And the next day, we'd be taking somebody else's place. So the whole war we passed there at Mrs. Truman's, and to eat, this is what really got me, was that I didn't have any money. None of us had any money. Maybe some of their parents were sending them a $50 or $25 or something, but I didn't have any. And I started getting hungry, and I noticed when I came in at nighttime, it was dark, and there were two pear trees in the yard, and nobody picked the fruit off of them. So I started picking up the fruit and putting it in my pocket and taking it upstairs, and I'd share it with the rest of my buddies upstairs. You know, at least we have a couple of pears to eat, you know. And then I was so angry. I was angry and happy at the same time, if you can imagine that, because at least we had something else. To this day, I still love the fruit, you know. I get sick over it, but I still admire it. And those people did all they could to help us kids, because we were just kids. We weren't men yet, you know. Mm-hmm. And so what they did, the other thing was the whiskey. Liquor was rationed, okay. And one day Mrs. Truman stopped me in the hallway, and she said, "Phil, if you're going downtown, would you stop at the liquor store and get me a bottle of something, you know?" And I didn't know. I'll do it, you know. So, but at the same time, I got one for me, too, a bottle, okay? Okay, so now here I am up in her house, her upstairs in that apartment where we all were sleeping, you know. And she cooked something for us to eat. And I took a drink. The next thing I knew, I blacked out. I don't remember nothing that happened after that, you know. I just went out. And I had never experienced a blackout like that. But it was straight whiskey, because you were entitled to one bottle every week or something like that, you know. And so anyway, I was a pretty sick boy the next day. I hung over pretty sick, but I had to go to work. So cold water, and I got to work all right. And I made it. Some of us didn't feel like going to work, and we didn't feel like doing anything, but because the war, the pressure of the war, we got to help end this war. I made it, you know. But that was part of my story, too, the liquor that we drank. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now you want me to continue?
Mm-hmm.
The blackout stage of alcoholism. When I reached that as a kid up there in Seattle, all I remember is I couldn't remember what happened yesterday or last night. I knew something had happened, but I didn't know what it was. And we were all in the same boat. They couldn't remember. The lieutenant couldn't remember. And old Leo Wells, the engineer over here, he couldn't remember. So we were all in the same boat. We drank so much the night before, we couldn't remember. That was the blackout stages. And that became more close, more often. And it took us to places that we hit. We had no clue what was going on, you know. But the job had to still go. We had to be at that steel gate at the factory to go through into our machines and start building that B-17 that was the Enola Gate and the bombs. And so, now that I'm talking about it, I'm wondering, I don't even know how we made it. Honest to God, I don't know how we made it because I don't remember half of that stuff. Now it comes, some of it comes to me, but somehow somebody gave us something to eat, somehow somebody had a bottle, or somehow somebody had pills. And that was the other thing that came out during that war, was pills, you know? And we were taking anything we could take, because the guy next to you would say, oh man, you gotta try these, Phil. Man, these are really, these'll take you out of here, man. You know, another one would come up with something else, look like a banana. Oh man, this stuff is great, Bill. It's better than that other stuff, you know. And whatever it was, we tried it, you know. That's why sometimes after I sobered up, I wondered if I was still okay because of the damage, brain damage, because we start hearing about their brain damage that so many people got, you know. And by the grace of God, I'm still okay, you know? So I'm grateful for that. That's another way.
Tell me about the deal.
And we all woke up that morning knowing about the news. We heard it on the radio, okay? And so then we saw the traffic was all going downtown. And then so we went out and we jumped in the buses, no charge, and we ended up downtown Seattle. Thousands of us. You know, from all over. And everybody was celebrating. The war is over. It's all over now. You know? And I don't recall drinking then at all. You know, we were so happy that the war is over and the guys are coming home. You know, and we all had special friends that we knew were overseas and did they make it or didn't they? Still hits home. None of those guys never made it. We all wondered, how come we didn't? They made it home in a casket. We didn't know what we did. We miss doing something wrong? Or did we? What happened? How come Joe didn't make it back? Harry didn't make it back? Mike didn't make it back? It goes deep. It goes deep, deep, deep for me. Too many of my friends have never made it back. And God help anybody that said anything about him born on the streets, because we'd be in a gang fight in 15 seconds for all these guys that were making fun of us. It was, somebody already wrote books about it, the hell of war, the hell of war. And that's exactly what it was, boy. We didn't know for sure. Are we being conned? Is it for real? Yeah, but Joe didn't make it back. Mike didn't make it back. Harry didn't make it back. They blew his head off in Guadalcanal. They got him over here on the way back. And all this memory. Why? Why, for God's sake? But they kept saying, we gotta do what we gotta do, Bill. We gotta do what we gotta do. Even if it's unpleasant, that's all right. It's okay. Grateful to God that I was able to do something. And all the guys and the gals, all the women, God bless all the women, man, there were thousands of them that were there with us. They helped build it, they helped put it together. They helped grind it down on them, patiently wait for the steel to, you know, be all right and all this stuff. They deserve a lot of praise, a lot of praise forever, you know. And I'm just grateful that I made it through, and that's the only thing I got as a sign. But I still have the memory, and I still keep in touch with guys back home in Colorado that stayed in the service, went and stayed in Navy or Army, or, you know, they just made a lifetime job. But we always get together, and whenever we get together, and we all, because we all had friends that never came home, so we know, you know, what it was like. And we don't know how in the world could we get it across to these people in Washington that run the mill, you know, that it makes us angry. It makes me angry, you know, because goddamn it, they read a book or something, and they back then, that ain't it. You should have been there, man. You know, but still, they were immune, and they had, the government was running their show, so, you know. Okay, back me back to 1920. When did I say that?
26 when you were born, so you survived the date as well.
Say it again?
You said you were born in.
Yeah, okay. My preliminary entry into AA was 1956. And several years later, I picked up again, had a slip, they called it. I didn't remember understand that. I just know that something was going on in my life that was upsetting me. And I reverted right back to the same routine. I'll get a bottle, you know, and I started drinking again. But it didn't last. You know, it's like I was awakened by God himself or something. That's enough, Bill. That's enough. You know, and I went right back to my meetings. And that's what I've done all the time. Go back to my meetings, get a hold of all my sponsors and my sponsees, and carry the message to them, anybody who's having trouble, you know. So that's really the whole bit of mine, is giving it away, being available to help others, go to meetings, different meetings, just to remind myself that a meeting is a meeting is a meeting, you know. It don't make any difference whether it's black, white, yellow, pink, blue, whatever, you know.
Yes. You're surprised you did?
October...
66.
66. Because I was already so full in my head about what to do in an emergency. In other words, what to do when you picked up a drink. Consciously or unconsciously, because that happened to me right here. Mm-hmm. When I came back from overseas, I got an apartment upstairs in, I forget the name of the bird, but and they you could go out for walks and they had nice grounds. And so I picked something to eat for myself and I went out for a walk, and as I was walking around, oh, the OJ trial was on. Now that's been, I don't know how many years back now, but I have been watching the OJ trial on my TV, and this woman, a neighbor, came by, and she said, well, Phil, come over to my place. I've got a brand new TV, and there's something wrong with yours. It's not working. So come on over. So I go, I get out, and we walk over to her apartment, and I'm sitting there waiting for her to do whatever she's going to do, and she's fixing up something. I guess maybe a need or something, you know. And she's turned it on the TV, so my attention is over here on the trial, OJ trial. And so as she walks in, I see her carrying this, like a gallon jug. And she walks right over to my chair and sits it down right here. And I looked down and I saw it, and I said, her name was Irene. I said, Irene, that's not for me. I don't drink, Irene. I don't need to drink anymore. There was a time when I needed to drink all I could get, but not now, not anymore. So thanks a lot, but no thanks. Okay? And she looked at me and she said, by God, you really are an alcoholic, aren't you? Well, then her story came out. She did prison time. She was married to one of the richest men here in Florida. They owned all the orchards, you know? And I saw the newspaper article about it, but I didn't know her or him, you know. And so she told me about it. She said, she told me the whole story of how the mafia got in on it. And they told him, we want that land and everything that's on it. And of course, he resisted. So they just gave him a one trip ticket out of here. He disappeared. And of course, she got rich. They gave her a lot of money. And so it was quite a story. So she said, well, they printed in the Orlando Times. They printed in the Orlando Times every year or year and a half or something. Same story. Because it's a famous story about that couple, you know. And the mom, you know, I guess, was involved in it all. Anyway, and so and she approached me with that gallon by the chair, and I'm watching OJ over here, and I'm interested in that OJ trial, you know. And when I looked down, I said, Irene, that's not enough. If you got 20 bottles like this, maybe, but it ain't enough, Irene. Thanks a lot. You know, and I went on watching an OJ. And she said, by God, yeah, I guess you are an alcoholic, though. I said, yeah, by God, I am. I really am. You know, I don't drink, don't even think it, don't even talk about it. It's not a part of my life no more. And right now I'm just doing whatever God wants me to do. You know, help this little woman here. That's when I met Denise. And she was going to Valencia College. And she was driving an old car and it was breaking down. And I said, look, I'll drive you there. I'll take you there. I'm not working, so I'll drive you to the college. So I did. And of course, I got to meet all the professors over there and all the people over there. And, and then I kept encouraging Denise, don't stop. Keep on going. Don't stop. Don't stop. Mm-hmm. And I followed her all through that whole scenario of going to school and getting her PhD. And now she's got her PhD. And she's arrived. She's got her own business now, you know. And that's when she invited me over here. And she had a bunch of dogs. She has a bunch of dogs all the time, you know. And I took a look at the dogs and I thought, oh my God, I love dogs. So they all come running to me. And I love it. I love dogs. But I saw the yard. There was no fence. Okay. The grass was about that high. Yeah, I can cut that in the plants. So I got busy and I said, but I'm going to need some help. Can you get a nurse, one of those male nurses, to come over and help me? Hold the fence up just so we can cement it down, you know? And so she did, and the guy was... It was the day that the hurricane came up from Tampa. You remember that?
Yeah.
And, but we... I didn't know nothing about that. It's windy, but it's always windy, you know? But we got started, and I dig the holes, and he prepared the cement, and we started putting the fence up. Holy cow, in the middle of it, though, she's got a tree in the backyard, and you've probably seen it, it's, the limbs are that thick. It's an old, old, old tree, and that thing was falling apart, you know, and it's a slope. Well, here it is right here, it's a slope, you know, and it was all wet, so I was slipping and falling all over the place, and we wanted to get hurry up and get it done, you know. So I can't remember the boy's name now, but he helped. Between me slipping every third step I took, I was falling, and but I'd jump right back up again and pick up another one of these. That's all one piece, you know. And to carry them, they're heavy, but when you're man enough or hurry enough, you got the adrenaline with you, you know. And we got her up, you know. And by the time Denise got home from work, it was all done. So I teased her now, you know. I said, well, and the dogs, see, she had the dogs too. Chico was one of the dogs. And I love dogs. And I'm very partial to dogs, especially the wild kind, you know. Because I grew up with them like that in Colorado. And so we got the fence up. I took her up to some shop where you could buy these plants. And I said, I'll help you. I'll pick them up, plant them in over here, and fix the rest of the fence around the place here. And we've done that. You know? So I, for some reason, I have this feeling that I was supposed to help her. You know, help. Wherever you needed help. And so I've done that, you know. We get into Donnybrook's every once in a while, her and I, you know, because she's Irish and, and I'm not. And so I get my dander up, okay? but she's got the education. She got her PhD. Yeah. And she's helping other people. And knows that she was driving an old car that was falling apart every hour and a half, you know. And I couldn't afford to buy her one, but I use my car to drive her to meetings and take her to meetings. And finally she looked out and she got herself a car. Now she's driving that little Toyota. And it gets there, you know, but I see her as a struggling woman, you know, and because of my grandmother would always counsel me about helping the women too. You know, they don't know what you men know, so don't be afraid to help them out once in a while, you know. And so that's what I've done with Denise, is help her out. And then of course her dad was a survivor of the war,
right.
You know, and that bonded me to him and to her too, because I thought he got captured by the Germans over in the Battle of the Bulge or something. So I know he went through his hell. But that's kind of it, you know. I seem to be put here on earth to help others. And when they show up, like Denise showed up, I have to laugh because it was so comical. Because here it is raining. I'd never been here before. I'm from the other side of the world, okay? But that rain would come, and she's at the college, and she's all done, and I gotta pick her up and bring her home, now, check the dogs. One of the dogs got away, and he's off the street, so I got to jump in the car and go looking for the dog. So we've gone through all that bout of trying to keep the family together over here. I said, you know, we'll be all right. We'll be all right. To me, the steps are the most beautiful trip that anybody can take anytime and discover some things that are out of this world for you, you know? And I'm just, copied what my sponsor used to tell me, you know. Don't be afraid, Bill. He saw that I was afraid to try to work the steps because I didn't go to school. I didn't have a high school education or college or anything. But I thought we'll all do the best we can. And it's it. That's all. That's it right there. You know, just do the best you can, you know. And little by little, I began to do just what Charlie was telling me. And every time we'd get back together again, he'd say, you're coming right along, Bill. You're coming right along. Well, that meant it, so I'm okay then. I'm okay. Okay, well then up the road here, something else comes up. And now I don't know how to deal with that one, you know. So he just reminded me, he'd say, you know, well, it's kind of like a piece of rope, Bill. You got to look for the end of that rope where you can tie a knot on it, you know. And when he'd say things like that to me, it would happen. I'd piece it together and then he'd, wow. And then he was a member of, he was an old timer, you know, from the Depression and all that. He went through a lot of pain during the Depression in this country. And he joined the Army and went overseas and fought in the trenches over there and came home. And then he catches yellow fever. I never even heard that word before until I met Charlie. And I said, what do you mean, yellow fever? He said, well, Bill, it's when we disembarked over in the East Coast. When we disembarked there, they put us in barracks. And then the war was getting over, but yellow fever had struck the nation. I never heard of yellow fever striking the nation because I wasn't here. I was over there. And so when he told me about it, he said, there was nothing to see in the barracks. He said, every morning we'd have to pull out the bodies because 20, 30 men in there all went to sleep last night, right? But today there's only 5 left alive, the rest are dead. And now that they got yellow fever in it, yeah, what's that? He said, well, it's some kind of a disease or something. So they couldn't get enough volunteers to pull out the bodies. So Charlie volunteered, though, and that's what got my attention with him. Charlie said he volunteered to go. Well, what was happening was every time you touched the corpse, you got it. So they were passing it on, something terrible to all the rest of the GIs, you know. And Charlie made it. And so that really solidified me with Charlie. He's been through hell and back already, and he over there in some other side of the country, in the world, you know. And he helped all his brothers out, all his sisters out, you know. So this guy's working the program. So that's the only way I could say it was Charlie's working the program. Okay. That means you're powerless over alcohol, and your life has become totally unmanageable. If you can't believe that, then you got to go out and do some searching now. And I don't mean get drunk again, but maybe it's going to turn to that, you know. The point is, you got to be ready for this program. You got to humble yourself to be willing to go to any length to get them. And you read them, and you read them, and you read them. Repetition, repetition. And then you do the best you can. You're never going to do it perfect. You're just going to work at it, you know. And those are the steps that are going to take you up out of this pit that we're in. You know? And things will come to you clearly, 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 you know. And so I followed his training for me, and I did just that. I carried that book with me wherever I was at. If I had time to sit and read a little while, pull under a tree somewhere and read a little bit more, because I didn't understand all the words, long words, you know. So I have to give Charlie the credit, you know, because I didn't do it. Exactly. God could and would if he were sought. And I didn't realize it, but I was talking to the man, Charlie. He was the man that had it, what I wanted. And I used to watch him like a hawk, you know. He cooked the best mulligans, too. And he had dogs. He always had dogs. You know. I never will forget when I first met him, and he says, I want to give you an experience you've never had in your life, Bill. Wait till we get to the front door of my little house here. Yeah, what's he talking about? So we get to the door, and I heard the dogs barking. I thought, oh, he's got a bunch of dogs. So he said, you're going to see love personified. Well, I never heard that term before. What's the name? Love personified. Because they know how to love a man better than anybody can. And he caught my attention. I'm curious now. So he opens the door, and up jumps this little tiny little terrier. Little bit. But he bounced right up in the air and landed on Charlie's shoulders. And Charlie just started loving him and walking in the house with him. And I thought, wow, a man that loves dogs that much, I got to know him. And I did, you know. And because it was pure love. It wasn't all phony, you know. And to me, I guess that's what we're all looking for. It's a real thing, you know. That whatever it is that turns us on, that sparks our attention or, you know, or brings us to a level of wanting to do something, you know. Because that's the way, really, that's all my life, that's what I've done. I listened to Grandma first. My grandmother was, she was something else. She was a medicine woman in the tribe. She knew every tree, every limb, every piece of grass and flower. She knew. Because I used to wonder. She'd say, all right, climb the tree for me up there and get me 6 of those leaves off that tree. And I wonder, what in the world is she going to get 6 limbs off of a tree? I don't know. So we'd get them, put them in the bag, bring them home. And by the time we'd get home, some other women would be standing at the door waiting for her to show up. She was the medicine woman in the tribe, see? And the women were waiting for her to come home because she brought the medicine home. And so she brought them into the house, put the coffee on, and then make a tea. And she'd give me a little tiny bit and give her enough to drink that tea down, you know. And then she'd be talking to her, saying, you know, when you're going to feel better right away. You're going to start feeling better right away. Positive, see? She didn't even know what the word positive was. I didn't either, but I was learning from her. And so, here pretty soon, but nobody had any money, so they couldn't, the depression was on. Nobody had any money. You couldn't buy anything. But they would come with a watermelon or some flowers, something. And my grandma would be so happy at receiving that little humble little plant as a gift. And she would just go on and on talking in front of me and with me of how good God was. See how good God is to us? We got flowers we didn't have them before. We got a fat banana, some of that, we didn't have them before. We got an apple. We didn't have that before. Yeah. Everything was big deal, you know? Mm-hmm. And so my grandmother's influence on me, as you can see, was deep and strong, you know? But when I got into society, out there with the people, I couldn't understand why do they do that? Why do they say those things about their brother or the neighbor or somebody? I just have to shut up. Don't say nothing. Listen to Grandma. You listen to Grandma. And I can't wait till the day that we meet up in heaven, her and I. Because she prepared me. Not my mother, not my dad, but Grandma did. In her simple, simple way of saying something or doing something, you know. She's the one that found me bleeding to death after the explosion. She heard the explosion a few miles away, and she knew it was me. See, that power? And she come running, ripping off her stockings. And I can still remember seeing her as she was ripping off her stockings because the blood was just gushing out of me. And then I lost consciousness, and I woke up in the hospital. But my grandmother. She could take anything, take a flower, and make it into something, you know? She creative, very creative. And she never put anybody down. Now, here's the big one. When one day my grandma said to me, "Have you seen that little black boy that everybody's beating up on?" I said, "Yeah, Grandma. I jumped in yesterday and they hit me too." And she said, you keep doing that. Keep doing that. His name was Obama. Imagine that? Obama. And so I got into more fights. My blood bloodied up and everything. They stopped and the guys, "Leave him alone, goddammit. Get the hell out of here and leave him alone." You know? And, but it was my grandmother's prompting, see, to do the right thing. And that became symbolic to me then, to do the right thing. Not go out and kill somebody or an animal. God forbid if she saw you stepping on an ant or an animal or anything. Or she would really tear into you, you know. Because that ant is more important than you are. More important than you are. It does more work than you do. Than you will ever do. And I didn't understand. But as I grew older, I found out, yeah.
Okay.
Willing to go to any length.